Les colloques du Collège de France.
Nous restons sur cette question de la vérité avec Linda Zerilli, qui est professeure à l'Université de Chicago, après avoir occupé des positions à Princeton, à Stanford, reçu de nombreux prix, dont celui de la Fondation Humboldt. Ses recherches aborde les questions d'études de genre, de féminisme, de théorie féministe au croisement du langage, de l'esthétique et de la démocratie. Citons parmi vos derniers livres « Feminism and the Abyss of Freedom » à Chicago en 2005, « Democratic Theory of Judgment » 2016 et « Democratic Theory of Truth » Chicago 2025. C'est très exactement de cela dont il s'agit dans votre communication, Foucault, un Democratic Theory of Truth.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thanks to the Collège de France for this invitation, and most particularly to Professor Didier Fassin for this lovely invitation. Generally speaking, my interests are in democratic theory and feminist theory. I won't be talking about feminist theory today. I will be talking about democratic theory. And I'm very interested in bringing Foucault into those debates in contemporary democratic theory and bringing him into debates with sort of unlikely interlocutors. In this case, it will be Hannah Arendt. Over the 4 years of Donald Trump's first term as US president, the Washington Post documented more than 30,000 of his false or misleading claims. Since his re-election in 2025, the pace has not slowed. He has claimed to have inherited 9% inflation, it was 3%, and to have cut drug prices by 300 to 600%, which no arithmetic can support. He has put border crossings under his predecessor at 25 million. The real figure is closer to 5 to 7 million, and has claimed that illegal immigrants filed millions of fraudulent Social Security claims for which there is no evidence. He has taken credit for a ceasefire between India and Pakistan that India denies, and he has insisted for months that the illegal war his administration, together with Israel, started with Iran, has already been won. Eventually, most of Trump's claims are fact-checked, sourced, and refuted. The machinery of verification runs without pause, and yet the lies proliferate. Donald Trump did not create the post-truth condition, but he has made it impossible to ignore. To critics, the diagnosis is clear. People are mistaking the false for the true. Fix their reasoning and restore their access to reliable information, and the problem will be solved. This talk argues that the standard diagnosis is mistaken. The problem we face is not the epistemic one it identifies, and the familiar remedies cannot work. To show why, I turn first to Hannah Arendt and then at greater length to Michel Foucault. Arendt distinguishes between two categorically different forms of political lying. The first is the traditional lie. It is a deliberate misrepresentation of a specific fact for a specific political purpose. The liar knows the truth and conceals or falsifies it. The historical revisionist, for example, knows that Belgium did not invade Germany in August 1914, just as President Richard Nixon knew about Watergate. The traditional lie can be fact-checked. Expose the misrepresentation, restore objective truth. And under normal circumstances, Arendt writes, the liar is defeated by reality. The second kind of lie is what Arendt calls the modern lie. It is categorically different. The modern lie does not aim to misrepresent a particular fact. It aims to destroy the very framework that allows facts to be distinguished from fiction. It does not substitute a false claim for a true one. It erodes the shared world, the common sense, that makes the distinction between true and false possible in the first place. Arendt describes this with devastating precision. The outcome of the modern lie, she writes, is not that the lies will now be accepted as truth and the truth be defamed as lies, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world is being destroyed. And then the sentence I want to put at the center of this lecture, if everybody always lies to you, the consequence is not that you believe the lies, but rather that nobody believes anything any longer. This peculiar cynicism, an absolute refusal to believe in the truth of anything, no matter how well this truth may be established, was not, she insisted, restricted to the terror-ruled regime she examined in The Origins of Totalitarianism. In later texts, Crises of the Republic, Arendt made clear that the modern lie is equally at home in democracies. Nobody believes anything anymore. That is the condition. Not false belief, not even disbelief, a deeper, more corrosive cynicism. The sense that nothing is worth believing, that truth and falsehood are equally beside the point, that indifference to truth is the only rational posture. This is what the tally of Trump's lies fails to capture, and why epistemological solutions like fact-checking do not work. It is not that his supporters believe 30,000 falsehoods. Rather, the endless production of lies, brazen and easily refuted and immediately replaced by new ones, has created a political condition in which the very distinction between truth and falsehood just seems beside the point. The lies are not primarily meant to deceive. They're meant to disorient, to produce the cynicism in which no one believes anyone or anything anymore, no one cares about truth, and fact-checking just becomes another form of partisan noise. Against this condition, the modern lie, the standard remedy is structurally helpless. More facts cannot restore the shared world that the modern lie erodes. The problem, in other words, is not epistemic. It is political. It is the dissolution of the public realm, the shared world in which facts can acquire force, plural opinions are tested against one another, and truth-telling can matter. No accumulation of verified facts or renewed commitments to objectivity can directly address that dissolution. What is needed is not better epistemology, but a recovery of the political conditions under which truth can matter at all. And this is exactly where Foucault becomes deeply relevant. When it comes to addressing post-truth, why turn to Foucault? After all, say his critics, isn't Foucault himself post-truth's faithful prophet? Jacques Bouveresse charges him with collapsing truth into power. Nancy Fraser argues that his genealogical practice implies critique without being able to justify it. Charles Taylor claims that his Nietzschean picture of truth undermines the possibility of intelligible resistance. Despite these differences, all three critics make the same error. Each operates strictly within what Foucault calls the analytics of truth. In each case, Foucault is held to standards internal to a tradition focused exclusively on cognitive issues of correct reasoning and veridicality, which he does not, in fact, reject, but is explicitly working to displace as the only tradition that matters for democracy. The analytics of truth is concerned with how to make sure a statement is true, but it presupposes rather than examines how we can know who is telling the truth and why democratic citizens ought to care about truth in the first place. Against these critics, I will argue that a democratic response to post-truth requires precisely this displacement effected by Foucault, precisely because what is at stake in post-truth is not a problem or primarily a failure of reasoning, but the erosion of the political conditions under which truth can have force at all. Foucault is unambiguous, quote, "Only truth can legitimately show the true. Only the game of truth and falsity can demonstrate what is true," unquote. He disputes then not that there is truth, but that truth compels submission by its own force alone. That force is not intrinsic to truth, he argues. It is something that democratic citizens give to truth through their practices of speaking, acting, and holding one another accountable in public. Foucault's account is uniquely suited to respond to what Arendt called the modern lie. Not the traditional substitution of falsehood for truth, but an assault on the very distinction between the true and false that ultimately reduces or results in the peculiar cynicism in which telling truth is impossible and eventually no longer matters. Working within the analytics of truth, Foucault's critics treat post-truth as a purely epistemic or cognitive problem, for which better fact-checking or normative criteria are the remedy. That framework cannot address what Arendt diagnosed as the far greater danger, the condition in which no one believes anything anymore, and public care for truth itself is the main casualty. Foucault's turn to the tradition of truth-telling and to parrhesia as its exemplary practice addresses the very problem defining our present condition. Foucault identifies two great traditions of thinking about truth, both originating in 5th century Athens and still very much alive today. He calls them the two sides of the great problematization of truth that marks the end of pre-Socratic philosophy and the beginning of a new kind of philosophy that is still ours. The first tradition is the one I've already mentioned, the analytics of truth. It is concerned with correct reasoning, veridicality, and the formal criteria for determining whether a statement is true. The second aspect of the great Greek problematization of truth is what Foucault calls the tradition of the question. Its main concern is not whether statements are true, but with who can tell the truth, why truth-telling matters for society, at what cost it is practiced, and what political conditions make it possible. Foucault says, quote, "This tradition is at the root, at the foundation of what we could call the critical tradition of philosophy in our society. While the analytics of truth frames truth as a problem of correct reasoning, the tradition of the question frames it as a problem of speech, risk, courage, and political obligation." The analytics of truth and the tradition of the question are not rival theories of truth. Rather, they are different ways of framing truth as a problem. According to the analytics of truth, the force of truth to compel the subject's submission belongs to the game of truth itself. Truth is assumed to have an intrinsic coercive force. As Foucault puts it, the truth is sufficient upon itself unto itself for making its own law. The coercive force of truth resides within truth itself. What obliges me in the procedure of the manifestation of truth is the structure of truth itself. It is truth itself, and that's all. This is a superhistorical idea of truth according to which the truth or falsity of a statement has nothing to do with the speaker, nothing to do with what human beings say, nothing to do with us. Within the framework of the analytics of truth, the contemporary problem of democracy and post-truth is one of cognitive disruption. Something is preventing citizens from tracking the truth as they should. Restore the tracking mechanism, and the force of truth will do the rest. Truth itself will compel cognitive agreement and compliance among socially diverse subjects. Questioning the received notion that truth itself determines its regime, makes the law, and obliges me, Foucault introduces the idea of historically situated games of truth on the one hand and regimes of truth on the other. As Daniele Lorenzini argues, this distinction separates the epistemic acceptance of a truth claim from practical submission to it. It has gone virtually unnoticed in the critical literature on Foucault, not least because it has allowed his critics to reduce his concept of truth to power. Foucault himself never denies that there is such a thing as truth. The epistemological or logical criteria of truth belong to the game. What he disputes is that once we agree that something is true, we are bound to whatever practical consequences or obligations flow from it, that is, to the regime. Unlike the game, a regime of truth is the historically specific set of practices and obligations by which subjects bind themselves to truth and give it ethical and political force. It belongs not to the formal structure of the game, but to the practices in which subjects manifest truth, take it up, assume obligations towards it, and act on it. Although the distinction between a game and a regime of truth is more analytic than real, in other words, there is no game of truth without a regime of truth, and vice versa, it foregrounds the formation of allothurgic subjects or subjects of truth. It allows Foucault to clarify what he calls the government of men by the truth. According to Foucault, truth governs only insofar as the subject manifests it. To manifest truth is to lend it more than the epistemological value of correctness. It is to bind oneself to its practical consequences, thereby giving truth moral, social, and political force over the conduct of citizens. This binding, of course, can be done by conforming subjects, those who manifest truth in ways that uphold existing and unjust power relations. But it can also be done by those who bind themselves to truths that upend the status quo, or by those who refuse to let a purely epistemic idea of truth dictate how they are obligated to act. Consider what this means in practice. Take the citizen who accepts that a war is just. The truth of the just war claim is not in dispute. The aggression occurred, and the legal and moral criteria are met. Yet the citizen refuses to enlist or pay taxes that fund the war, on the grounds that the practical consequences drawn from that truth, this war, fought in this way by this government, do not warrant her submission. It is true that the war is just, she might say, but I am not obligated to follow the practical consequences and fight or support it. The therefore that connects a game to a regime of truth remains a decision, not a logical consequence of the truth claim itself. Furthermore, within the framework of the analytics of truth, the problem of how to determine whether a statement is true says nothing about how to recognize who is telling the truth. Why should we care whether a statement is true? And perhaps more importantly, why should we risk anything to say what is true, especially in societies where the truth teller is more likely to be ridiculed and ostracized, if not imprisoned or killed? This raises political questions that cannot be solved by epistemic means. For both Arendt and Foucault, the specifically political problem of truth stems from its long entanglement with democracy. Democracy is an institutional system of equality in which all citizens have the right to speak. This is isagoria. But the equal right to speak is not the equal ability to tell the truth. Parrhesia, frank speech, the willingness to say what one believes regardless of the consequences, is not evenly distributed. There can be, as Foucault puts it, bad parrhesia. Flattery, demagoguery, the saying of whatever is expedient. The democratic problem, then as now, is how do we recognize who is actually telling the truth when everyone has the right to speak? That is the problem that gave rise to the tradition of the question, the critical tradition Foucault calls our own. Foucault is clear about its stakes, quote, for there to be democracy, there must be parrhesia. For there to be parrhesia, there must be democracy, unquote. The relationship is circular and fragile. Democracy makes parrhesia possible by granting the right to speak, but it also makes parrhesia dangerous by granting that right to everyone, including the flatterer, the demagogue, and the producer of alternative facts. Parrhesia, as Foucault analyzes it, is not defined by its epistemic credentials, but by the bond between speaker and speech, and by the risk that the speaker assumes. The parrhesiast tells the truth, even when it is unwelcome, even when doing so puts a speaker's relationship with her community at risk. What distinguishes her from the flatterer is not access to better facts. It is the ethical and political quality of her speech, the courage to say what she believes is true, to whom it must be said, at personal cost. Reducing truth-telling to correct reasoning misconstrues the genuine threat to democracy, growing cynicism toward parrhasia, the open expression of citizen opinion, which is its home. But that is not all. There is also growing cynicism toward the very possibility of critique. Foucault argues that parrhasia's primary function is criticism. Criticism of oneself, the speaker, or criticism of the interlocutor. He writes, the function of parrhasia is not to give a demonstration of the truth, but it is not a discussion or a contest about truth with somebody else. Parrhasia is a form of criticism that comes from below and is oriented towards those above. The parrhasiast always has less power than the one to whom he speaks, unquote. What is at stake in Frank's speech, then, is more than the truth understood in an epistemic sense. It is the risk in saying an unwelcome truth, the effect that Frank's speech has on the relationship between speaker and addressee, and ultimately the effect that this Frank speaking has on the public world we share. Foucault helps us to see that this effect of parrhasia belongs not to truth itself, but to the force of truth the speaker gives to any specific truth claim. Citizens can accept the epistemic validity of a fact. They can fully recognize that it is true, and yet make no connection to, therefore, I must act. This is the difference between the game of truth and its regime. We can now grasp more precisely what Arendt's modern lie produces. To state, as she does, that no one believes anything anymore is not to identify, as I said, an epistemic failure. Not the loss of belief in a fact, but the loss of belief in the idea that truth matters. The modern lie does not necessarily destroy the game of truth. Facts continue to be checked, refuted, and confirmed. What it destroys is the regime of truth, the political practices and shared obligations through which citizens give truth force. Facts are not only real, they have political significance. That is, practical public consequences for how one acts. When those practices have become sufficiently eroded and cynicism has reached the point at which nobody believes anything any longer, games of truth can continue to run, but they run in a void. The check fact lands nowhere. It binds no one. It changes nothing. Two examples make this concrete. In 2005, London's Sunday Times published the Downing Street memos, which showed that the Bush administration had fabricated the case for the invasion of Iraq. In Britain, this disclosure nearly brought down Tony Blair's government. In the United States, it was noted by a handful of opposition senators and promptly dismissed as old news. The facts were available, they were verified, and they were accepted as true. But they produce very few, if any, immediate political consequences. Compare this with the Pentagon Papers, the classified government documents on the Vietnam War that Daniel Ellsberg leaked to the New York Times in 1971. Much of what Ellsberg disclosed had already been publicly debated for years. What was new was not the information, not the facts. What was new was the act of disclosure. A man who knew he faced life imprisonment on espionage charges, choosing to say publicly, here is what I know, and I am obligated to act on it. That act created a political event. The event was not primarily a revelation of something utterly unknown. It was shock at discovering how brazenly the Nixon administration had lied, and the courage of a man who came forward despite the risk that made the Pentagon Papers explosive. This difference is not epistemic. It is the difference between a fact circulating with the game of truth and a fact manifested within a regime of truth by a subject who assumes responsibility for it. This is why, in the US context, Ellsberg's disclosure was parrhasia, whereas the Downing Street memos were not. not because one contained truer facts than the other, but because one was an act, an assumption of personal obligation towards truth under conditions of genuine risk, whereas the other was merely correct information. Information alone does not produce the force of truth. Only a subject who assumes personal responsibility for it can do that. This is what Foucault teaches. This is not relativism. It is more precise account of how truth functions in political life and of what the modern lie destroys. But for truth to have force, there must be not only those willing to tell the truth, but also those willing to receive it. Not only the parrhesias, but a public capable of recognizing frank speech as such, capable of distinguishing the truth teller from the flatterer, the act of disclosure from the partisan talking point. That capacity is itself a political achievement, not a cognitive one. It requires a public realm in which truth telling is valued, where the courage to speak has an audience prepared to hear it. To conclude, the post-truth debate, I've argued, as it is currently conducted, frames the problem of truth in democracy as a cognitive issue. Citizens have been misled, manipulated, or have reasoned improperly. The remedy is epistemic, better information, reasoning, and verification mechanisms. Foucault does not deny the importance of any of this, but he insists that the problem of truth is more than a matter of correct reasoning. When fact-checking dismisses citizen opinion as cognitively worthless, when expertise replaces judgment, and when the force of truth is assumed to reside in truth itself, rather than in the practices by which citizens constitute it as a shared reality, we deepen the very conditions that make the modern lie effective. We confirm cynicism. We reinforce the sense that truth is imposed from outside rather than a matter of public importance to which citizens hold themselves and each other accountable. The tradition of the question, the critical tradition Foucault recovers in his study of parrhesia, points to a different understanding. Truth is not a property of statements that compels assent by its own force. It is a political practice. It is an ethical practice. It is what citizens do when they speak frankly to one another, take responsibility for what they know, and insist on the consequences of affirming what is true. That is what it means to make a fact politically significant. That practice requires a public realm robust enough to sustain it. It requires citizens who understand truth-telling as an obligation, not merely truth-tracking as a skill. But it also requires understanding truth as something that can be found in opinion and in its exchange with others. This is what a democratic theory of truth requires. Not the restoration of truth with a capital T, indifferent to human opinion in public life, but the cultivation of the practices, the parrhesiastic practices, through which truth gains force in democratic societies and the therefore links it is true to then I must act. That is Foucault's contribution to the post-truth debate. And it is, I want to suggest, one of the most urgent contributions a critical thinker can make to the crisis we currently face. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.